My episodes on Guadalcanal and the Solomons campaign have been, up to this point, very Marine-centric, and for good reason, as the Marine squadrons bore the brunt of the fighting. I talked about the Army Air Force's involvement a little bit with the episode on the 67th Fighter Squadron, but have largely glossed over the U.S. Navy's participation. From day one of the fight in the Solomons, Navy carriers were there, providing cover for the Marine forces going ashore on Guadalcanal, then participating in multiple carrier engagements over the next 6 months. In addition to the carrier presence, from time to time, Navy squadrons would be based ashore. Early on, it was aircraft who had lost their home when their carrier was damaged or sunk. Initially, like the Marines, the Navy's frontline fighter was the Wildcat. But as the months wore on and the fight progressed up the Solomon's chain in 1943, the Wildcat gave way to the Hellcat as the Navy's primary fighter. And Marine Corsairs and Navy Hellcats operated side by side. Then in late October 1943, a unique sight occurred in the Solomons. A U.S. Navy Corsair squadron arrived in the form of VF-17, the Jolly Rogers, under the command of Lieutenant Commander Tom Blackburn. They weren't supposed to be there, but they were going to make the most of their time in the Corsair and in the Solomons. Welcome to the Aviation Medals of Honor. The Corsair was always supposed to be a Navy carrier aircraft, with the original Navy requirement for a new single-engine carrier-based fighter coming in 1938. The Vought Aircraft Company proposal beat out several others, and the prototype Corsair first flies in 1940, and from its initial flight shows great promise. If everything had progressed smoothly with the Corsair from there, we may have never seen the F-6F Hellcat, and carriers full of Corsairs would have been the standard by mid-1943. However, as I talked about back in Ken Walsh's episode, there are carrier compatibility issues that the Navy had identified with the Corsair during flight test, in particular the stall tendencies. During a power-on stall, like with what would happen on an approach to a carrier, the Corsair's left wing would stall first because of the differing airflow over the wings due to pockwash. The result was a vicious left wing drop and roll. At the altitudes involved in a carrier approach, that would likely be fatal. In the hands of an experienced aviator, maybe not much of a worry, as they aren't going to get themselves into an approach turn stall situation. But the Navy was in the process of putting out thousands of new aviators a year, and the experience level just wasn't what it was pre-war. For a land-based aircraft, adding a few knots to approach speed and accepting a little float on landing is probably going to be okay, but not on a carrier approach. The Corsair's landing gear were presenting an additional issue as well, as it tended to bounce on anything but a smooth landing. Obviously, that's not very good for a carrier aircraft, but despite the issues, the Navy has two squadrons lined up to receive the Corsair. VF-12 would be the first, followed by VF-17. VF-12 gets their Corsairs in late 1942, alongside VMF-124, the 1st Marine Corsair Squadron. The Marine Squadron is slated for land basing in the Solomons, while VF-12 is supposed to take the Corsair to sea. They do that in the spring of 1943, but not without problems. They lose 7 pilots during the course of their training and carrier qualifications, and consider the Corsair a difficult aircraft to fly. With one pilot saying about it, quote, "This plane is as cooperative as a hog on ice," unquote. By July of 1943, VF-12 has exchanged their Corsairs for Hellcats. While the Hellcat didn't quite match the performance of the Corsair, it was still superior to anything the Japanese had, with the added bonus that it was much more docile around the boat than the Corsair. While VF-12 was on the West Coast working through the teething problems with the Corsair in early 1943, VF-17 is concurrently working through the same issues on the East Coast of the U.S. For some reason, VF-17 takes to the Corsair much more readily than VF-12. VF-17 had formed in January 1943 under the command of Lieutenant Commander Tom Blackburn. Blackburn was a 1933 graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy. He had earned his wings and was working as a flight instructor teaching fighter tactics when the war broke out. His repeated requests for a combat assignment were finally granted in July 1942, when he was given command of VGF-29, a Wildcat squadron flying off the escort carrier USS Santee. In November 1942, VGF-29 and the Santee participated in Operation Torch, the Allied invasion of North Africa, where Blackburn's and VGF-29's combat debut is pretty much a disaster. In marginal weather, his flight of five fails to find their assigned target, then are all forced to ditch or crash land ashore when they can't find the carrier in the bad weather upon their return. Blackburn ends up bobbing into the ocean in his raft for 3 days before being picked up by a destroyer. That one mission is the beginning and end of VGF-29's combat tour. Blackburn is sure his career is over, but it turned out there was an equipment issue on their carrier that caused the homing beacon to malfunction, and Blackburn's fight wasn't the only one lost. Shortly after the carrier returns to the U.S., Blackburn is ordered to stand up VF-17. It's a dream job for him. He gets another shot at squadron command and the chance to fly the Navy's hottest new fighter, the Corsair, and deploy with them aboard the USS Bunker Hill, a new Essex-class carrier. VF-17 forms as a squadron on 1 January 1943 at Naval Air Station Norfolk. Blackburn lets his pilots know that he wants no, quote, reluctant dragons, unquote, in his unit, and gets to forging a team of aggressive fighter pilots. Like many of the squadrons being thrown together at this stage of the war, he doesn't have many true fighter pilots, though. Only five of his 42 pilots assigned have any fighter time. For the rest, the most advanced aircraft they have flown is the SNJ Trainer. They have no Corsairs either. They won't start trickling in until mid-February, so initially training is done in SNJs and a few Wildcats, which actually turned out pretty good as an intermediate step into the big Corsair for the more inexperienced aviators. Blackburn gets busy building a team, and part of that is a squadron identity. In keeping with the Corsair theme, they choose the Jolly Rogers for their squadron name and get the skull and crossbones of the pirate Jolly Roger flag painted on their new Corsairs. The pilots have nicknamed their Corsairs Hogs after VF-12's earlier experience with it, and Blackburn's aircraft gets Big Hog painted on the aircraft's tail in recognition of his call sign. They get right to training with their new aircraft. While not quite rising to the level of Pappy Boeington and his Black Sheep, VF-17 does get a reputation around Norfolk as Blackburn's Irregulars, as they flat hat around the area, flying under bridges and flying so low they are running cars off the road, while inverted. Luckily for Blackburn, they are moved away from the purview of the big wigs at Norfolk and out to the Outer Banks of North Carolina, to Naval Auxiliary Air Station Manteo, where they continue their training for their eventual deployment on the USS Bunker Hill, one of the several new Essex-class carriers being built that would come online in 1943. Meanwhile, they tried to solve the two big issues challenging the carrier use of the Corsair: the tendency to bounce on landing and the dangerous stall characteristics. To fix the bounce issue, VF-17's engineering officer, a pilot whose ground job was working on the maintenance side of the squadron, worked with a VOUT representative to experiment with the servicing of the Corsair struts. They eventually find the right combination of servicing, and the bounce issue is largely resolved. The stall issue has a fix as well: the incorporation of a stall strip to the starboard wing. A stall strip is basically a small addition, just a few inches long, added to the leading edge of the wing. It's just enough to slightly disturb the airflow over the wing, which will cause it to stall a few knots earlier than a clean wing would. So the addition of the stall strip to the starboard wing of the Corsair made it so the wings would stall evenly, minimizing the hard left roll stall tendency of the Corsair. The other complaint of the carrier pilots was visibility over the long nose of the Corsair. Mount raises the seat and incorporates a semi-bubble canopy to increase visibility, which, while not totally fixing the issue, does help. All those changes will be incorporated into the F4U-1 Alpha, which will be the first truly carrier-ready model of the Corsair. But production line changes like that take some time. In the meantime, VF-17 carrier qualifies in its early birdcage model Corsairs. There are a few interesting moments, but they all qualify without killing anyone. In August of 1943, they received 36 of the new F4U-1 Alpha Corsairs. And on 10 September 1943, VF-17 sails on the Bunker Hill for the South Pacific and war as the Navy's first carrier-ready Corsair squadron. But there is a kink in that plan. The commander, Air Forces Pacific, under which the Bunker Hill and its air wing will be operating, has made the decision to have all his fleet carriers use the Grumman's F-6F Hellcat as their primary fighter. It's not an unreasonable decision. Even with the changes to the Corsair, the Hellcat remains an easier and safer aircraft to fly around the boat, although the Admiral's decision probably had more to do with the logistics. A single fighter type across all his carriers simplified his supply chain and made for a strong argument for operating a single type. Blackburn and VF-17 are offered the opportunity to transition to Hellcats in order to stay with the Bunker Hill. But by now the Jolly Rogers are in love with their hogs and decline the transition to what they saw as the inferior Hellcat. They fly off to Hawaii as the boat passes by on 2 October 1943. A fully trained and equipped Corsair squadron isn't just going to sit around, though. They are assigned to Com Air Solomons and soon catch a ride on a Jeep carrier to the Solomons, arriving on New Georgia on 27 October 1943. They fly their first combat missions the next day on the 28th. They aren't the first U.S. Navy Corsairs to fly combat, as the Night Fighter Squadron, VFN-75, had arrived in the Solomons about a month ahead of VF-17 and started flying night patrols with their F4U-2 radar-equipped Corsairs in early October. VFN-75's Lieutenant Hugh O'Neill Jr. shoots down a Betty bomber on the night of 31 October 1943. It's the Navy's first Corsair kill. Barely. A few hours later, early on 1 November, the Jolly Rogers engage Japanese aircraft for the first time in the skies off Bougainville. November 1st is D-Day for Admiral Halsey's amphibious invasion of Bougainville, going ashore at Cape Torokina, and the Japanese come down from Rabaul in waves throughout the day to oppose the landings. The Jolly Rogers get 6 kills on the day, with Blackburn leading the scoring with 2. They fly missions in support of the invasion for the next week or so, but after that first day, aerial opposition is sporadic. A few kills are added over the days, and Blackburn adds another to his total on the 8th. Then on 9 November, VF-17 is advised to put the tailhooks back on their Corsairs, which have been removed to save weight. There had been some naval surface action off the invasion beaches. The Japanese Navy had sorted out a task force consisting of 4 cruisers and 6 destroyers that first night of the invasion, November 1st, hoping to recreate their success of the Battle of Savo Island, in which a Japanese cruiser task force had crushed an American force off Guadalcanal back in August of 1942. It was a different U.S. Navy than the inexperienced group the Japanese faced back in 1942, though. Well-trained combat vets by now, the Navy screening force sinks 1 cruiser and a destroyer while damaging 2 additional cruisers and 2 destroyers. It's a resounding victory for the U.S. Navy, who escaped with 1 cruiser and 2 destroyers damaged. The survivors of the Japanese task force return to the harbor at Rabaul, where they meet up with additional heavy cruisers sent down from the Japanese fleet anchorage at Truk. Despite the losses of November 1st, it's still a formidable surface fleet sitting there at Rabaul, and the Navy wants to end that threat permanently. It launches a strike from the carrier Saratoga in Princeton on 5 November. VF-17 had been tasked with providing cover for those carriers as they launched their aircraft on the strike. But there was no opposition for VF-17 to deal with it on that day. While they turned circles on their combat air patrol over the carriers, the carrier aircraft damaged 6 of the 7 cruisers in harbor at Rabaul, with 4 of those being heavily damaged. Although most of the Japanese warships that were able to departed the next day on a retreat to Truk, the Navy is looking to follow up the success of 5 November with additional carrier strikes on 11 November. It's certainly a different war for the carrier Navy than it was back at the start of the Solomons campaign. Back then, the carriers were forced to retire early in the face of Japanese aerial opposition coming down from Rabaul, forcing the invasion fleet to retire as well and straining the 1st Marine Division without much of their supplies on Guadalcanal. At times down to a single carrier in 1942, the Navy had to be careful with the employment of its carriers, engaging when it could, but always quickly retiring to the safety of the open seas. However, by 1943, the U.S. industrial might started coming into play, and by the end of that year, the U.S. Navy will have 20 carriers at sea. Halsey can now afford to be aggressive and go toe-to-toe with a Japanese land-based force, something that would have been unthinkable in 1942. He has 3 additional carriers to follow up the strikes of 5 November, and VF-17, as well as Hellcats from the shore-based VF-33, will find combat air patrols protecting the carriers, which included VF-17's previous home, the Bunker Hill, while the carrier aircraft head to Rabaul to strike any remaining Japanese shipping there. This time, the 2 land-based Navy squadrons will trap on the carriers and refuel in order to cover an additional afternoon strike. The morning combat air patrol sees no Japanese resistance, and VF-17 lands aboard the carriers without incidents or even a wave off, despite a 2-month break from any carrier landings. They refuel before launching to resume the cap for the afternoon wave. It's a different story this time. A large Japanese force follows the strike aircraft back to the carriers. The inbound raid is detected on radar, and VF-17 and VF-33 are vectored to intercept. Inbound are 25 Val dive bombers and 15 Kate torpedo bombers, escorted by 65 Zeros. The attack comes near the end of VF-17's cap window, so they are low on fuel, but the Corsairs press their attacks despite their fuel slates and the heavy AAA thrown up by the fleet, and aircraft began to fall to the defending fighters. 2 Jolly Rogers would have to ditch due to fuel starvation, while several get permission to land back aboard the Bunker Hill. Lieutenant Ike Kepford was one of those. Several times his flight had turned for home, only to spot a new wave of Japanese attackers and pitching back into the fight. Ike Kepford is the highest scoring Jolly Roger of the day, with 4 kills, including a Kate torpedo bomber he splashes right as it's dropping his torpedo on the Bunker Hill. When Ike lands on her just a few minutes later, the ship's captain personally serves him up a steaming cup of coffee for his efforts in saving his ship. Overall, it's a big day for the Jolly Rogers, with 18.5 confirmed kills and 7 damaged. VF-17 continues flying missions around Bougainville throughout November, but the opposition falls off as losses mount for the Japanese. By the time VF-17 ends their first combat tour on 29 November, the Japanese have pulled their air assets back to Rabaul, and the airspace over Bougainville is firmly in the control of the Allies. Like their Marine counterparts, VF-17 was on a combat rotation cycle, and they are pulled off the line in early December and head to Australia for R&R leave. They have been credited with 45 victories to the loss of 2 Corsairs in combat, with an additional 3 operational losses, and had lost 3 pilots killed. Following their R&R, in a period of training back at Espirito Santo, they arrive at Piva Yoke, the newly opened fighter strip on Bougainville, in late January 1944. They are coming in towards the tail end of the fight for air dominance over Rabaul, but for now it's still in full swing, and the action is intense as the Jolly Rogers return to combat. Their first mission on return to combat has 32 of their Corsairs escorting SBD Dauntless dive bombers, on a strike to one of Erbil's several airfields. The F-17 shoots down 8 enemy aircraft, but lose 2 Corsairs and their pilots, and have an additional 4 Corsairs damaged. Blackburn gets 1, making him VF-17's first ace and the Navy's first Corsair ace. The action stays intense over the next several days. Over the 6-day period from 26 to 31 January 1944, the Jolly Rogers are credited with the destruction of 60 and a half enemy aircraft, more than their entire first tour. It's a rough period for the Jolly Rogers as well, with 13 Corsairs destroyed, 5 of them by enemy action, 4 in crashes after being shot up by the Japanese, 3 operational landing crashes, and 1 in a mid-air collision. 6 pilots are killed over the 6 days, and the way this first week of the return to combat has gone, the pilots of VF-17 begin to wonder if any of them will survive to see the end of this tour. The weather gives them a couple days break, and when missions continue up to Erbil, things seem different to the Jolly Rogers. The Japanese aren't showing the same aggressiveness or appearing in the same large groups as that first week of combat. That doesn't mean the end of action, just not on the same level. And it doesn't stop the Jolly Rogers from seeing continued success, including a 4-kill day by Commander Blackburn on 6 February. Those 4 will be the last of his 11 confirmed victories for the war. The last significant fight of the Erbil campaign takes place on 19 February, when the Jolly Rogers shoot down no fewer than 16 enemy aircraft off New Ireland. The previously mentioned Ike Catford gets 2 Zeeks and a Roofie, bringing his score to 16, making him the high scorer for the Jolly Rogers and the leading U.S. Navy ace of the war at the time. From then on, it's a quiet few weeks, some strafing missions, even putting bomb racks on and experimenting with the Corsair as a fighter bomber, a role which it will fulfill for the rest of the war and into the next war in Korea. The Jolly Rogers' second tour ends on 6 March 1944. They had been credited with the destruction of 106 and a half enemy aircraft during 1,099 combat sorties over their second tour, while losing 16 Corsairs and 10 pilots. Over 76 days of combat during their 2 tours, VF-17 flew over 2,579 combat sorties while scoring 152 and a half kills. In total, they lost 24 Corsairs and 13 pilots. They are the leading Navy squadron of the war so far, having made 13 aces, including the Navy's top ace, Ike Catford. Of VF-17's time in the Solomons, Commander Blackburn would say his proudest accomplishment was that they never lost a bomber they were escorting. While they did not complete a full carrier deployment, they proved the viability of the Corsair for carrier operations, and their initial carrier experience and work with Vought aircraft resulted in modifications to the Corsair that made it nearly as safe as the Hellcat around the boat. While the U.S. Navy initially balked at taking the Corsair to sea, the Royal Navy didn't, and started sending their Corsairs to sea in December of 1943, with Royal Navy Corsair-equipped squadrons operating in the Atlantic and Pacific throughout 1944. The Royal Navy certainly deserves credit for their contributions leading to the safe operation of the Corsair at sea. The U.S. Navy's first Corsair carrier deployments would be small night fighter detachments beginning in January 1944, but it wouldn't be until December 1944, a year after the Royal Navy, that U.S. Navy fleet carriers began to see traditional day fighter Corsair squadrons aboard. The first 2 squadrons, VMF 124 and VMF 213, were actually Marine squadrons that deployed with the USS Essex. Throughout 1945, Corsair squadrons, both Marine Corps and Navy, presence on U.S. carriers increased, and they would play a pivotal role in the big air battles off Okinawa and mainland Japan in 1945. Carrying out a majority of the Navy and Marine Corps fighter bomber sorties of the war, the Corsair was given the nickname Angel of Okinawa by the infantrymen on the ground. Post-war, its service in the carrier Navy continued, with the Corsair being a standard on carrier decks in the Korean War. The Corsair's numbers started to dwindle as AD-1 Sky Raiders and the early jets increasingly took over. By 1954, the only active duty squadrons left with Corsairs were the Navy's VC-3 and VC-4. VC-4 had the honor of being the last unit to fly the F-4U in frontline service. It retired the last of its F-4U-5Ns on 31 December 1955, although several Corsair squadrons soldiered on in the Marine and Navy reserves, with the last of those being retired in mid-1957. The last carrier-borne Corsairs served with the French Navy, finally retiring in 1964 when they were replaced by another Valt product, the F-8 Crusader. VF-17 was disbanded after their time in the Solomons, and its squadron pilots sent off to various assignments. Commander Tom Blackburn would later be selected as Commander Air Group 74 aboard the USS Midway, but the war would end before they saw combat. He would later command the carrier USS Midway before retiring from the Navy in 1962. VF-17 would be reformed, although without any of the original members, as a Hellcrat squadron, who carried on the skull and crossbones in the Jolly Rogers legacy. They went to sea aboard the USS Hornet and saw action at Iwo Jima, Okinawa, and then strikes against mainland Japan. They added a further 161 kills to VF-17's wartime totals, making it one of the top Navy squadrons of the war. Post-war, the Jolly Rogers went through a couple of redesignations, first as VF-5, then as VF-61. Before being deactivated in 1959. Following the deactivation of VF-61, VF-84's commanding officer, who had previously flown as a Jolly Roger in VF-61, requested to change his squadron's name and insignia to that of the Jolly Rogers. VF-84 had had a history with the Jolly Rogers, as a core group of the initial cadre for the squadron were from the original Jolly Rogers, including their first commander, Roger Hedrick, who was Blackburn's XO at VF-17. VF-84 would deploy on their old ship, the Bunker Hill, until knocked out of the war by kamikazes off Okinawa in 1945. So it was fitting that VF-84 would take the name and lineage of the Jolly Rogers when VF-61 was disestablished. VF-84 would carry the Jolly Rogers name and colors through combat tours with F-4 Phantoms in Vietnam and F-14 Tomcats in Desert Storm. VF-84 was disestablished in 1995, but the Jolly Rogers legacy was once again saved as VF-103, formerly the Sluggers, took up the Jolly Rogers name. Today they fly the F-18 Super Hornet, carrying on the legacy of the U.S. Navy's most famous squadron with the Jolly Rogers skull and crossbones prominently displayed on the Hornet's twin tails. An interesting side piece of history involves Ensign Jack Ernie and the Jolly Rogers. The legend was that Ensign Ernie, a new pilot to the Jolly Rogers, was shot down in combat during the invasion of Okinawa. Tracked in the cockpit and on his way down, Ernie's last transmission was said to be, quote, "Remember me with the Jolly Rogers," unquote. After his remains were recovered, his family presented his skull and femur bones, mounted in a glass case, to the men of the Jolly Rogers as a symbol of the traditions of the squadron. Now, with every change of command, the passing of the bones occurs, where the remains of Ensign Jack Ernie are passed from the care of the old skipper to the new one. It's one of the grand legends of naval aviation, although there are a couple problems with the legend, as there is no record of an Ensign Ernie flying with any iterations of the Jolly Rogers. Regardless, the bones of Ensign Ernie are now part of the long history of the Jolly Rogers that began with their hogs in the skies over the South Pacific. December 5.